Great. Thanks, Mark. And thank you for sticking around this late afternoon here and listening to this. Hopefully this will be a little more lively than my monotone voice up here. I'm going to show you some things that, well, you know, frankly surprised me, probably shouldn't have. Bob Hoag sitting out here. Bob and I, how long ago was that, Bob? 20 years ago, maybe? 15 years ago? We worked on, it's 20, it was some when Bob was with Red Angus, some ways to kind of process. I'm going to use a lot of euphemisms here because process. Birth weight data in particular, which I think I can prove to you it's a bit problematic, another euphemism. Out of that, we dealt with problematic birth weight data, and you might be asking yourself, okay, what's problematic birth weight data? Well, let me show you. This is output from a tool that we developed at that time, right, Bob? This looks familiar. And this is a report that comes out. It takes and looks at a whole contemporary group of birth weight. This is contemporary group 1000727, has 24 calves in it. If you look up here at the top, moderate-sized contemporary group. It fits on a screen mostly. Over here, where it says sire, that's actually the age of dam values, and the IDs on these animals have been blurred out to protect the innocent and the not so innocent at the same time. Here's the observations, and this is a contemporary group that I think I can convince you is a typical good contemporary group. It's real data, probably taken on a scale. It has all the characteristics of a good contemporary group. It looks like real data, smells like real data, probably is. The variance of observations, and these are raw birth weights, not adjusted for anything, variance of observations within the contemporary groups up here, and that's about what we expect. And what we did in this tool back 20 years ago is we just calculated the probability of a greater F, and that's a 0.73, the high number there says, oh, yeah, you know, that's not different than what we expect the variance of the contemporary group to be. So this is a good one. Just keep that in mind. Kind of look and range from what's the low here, 57 to 102, it all kind of makes sense. And then, I got started on this new project with the IGS team, and actually we've done a little bit with the Hereford team, too. We're going to come back and work on that some more. But we started working on a project. You know, we released EPDs a little over a year ago on the new system. And so we were coming back and said, well, let's do some things. Let's reestimate variance components. Let's look for a better marker subset, see if we can gain some accuracy, do some other things with age of dam, you know, that sort of thing. So I started on this project last fall, and I started poking around in it. And the first thing I did was, well, let's run this tool on all the birth weight data. And I'm going to show you birth weight data. I'm going to start with just the 2018 born calves. So these are all 2018 born calves in all these little reports I'm going to show you here. As we did this, just kind of looking at it, we started seeing way too much of this. Not credible. 15 observations. Variance within the group is only 5.4 squared pounds. Probability of a greater F is effectively zero. I don't know. Someone tell me that this is a real group. Someone tell me that he actually has this much homogeneity within the group. Doesn't look right to me. Does it look right to any of you?
No.
No. Okay. Yeah, let's make this interactive. If you want to stop me and ask questions or hit the BS buzzer on me, right in the middle of the program, let's do it. Okay. So we saw that. We saw things like this. Here's another one. Man, those are some good calves, nice and light, don't range much. Probability of a greater F, zero. Here's another one. You look at it and go, well, you know, he was sitting in his pickup truck writing down weights, and he knew he couldn't write down all 70s, so he wrote down all 80s. Well, probability of greater F, zero. This isn't just a problem with small contemporary groups either. You know, here's this contemporary group of size 61 because of the size, 6.7 squared pounds, 6.8 squared pounds variance. Probability of a greater F, really zero.
Wow, where'd that come from?
Really zero. See the weights? They all just kind of look in their 80s. There's a 79. That must have been out of a two-year-old. Yep.
Yeah. Well.
We even saw things like this. And this is much, remember, this is 2018. This is modern data. That is a uniform set of calves. Okay, so I'll show you how prevalent this is. And it's surprising, another euphemism. But then, as we went along, we also started seeing other anomalies, started exploring this more than just running these reports and looking at things. Started looking for things like this, and where there were big spikes on 75, 80, 85, 90, and there's a lot of this in there, too. And we started scratching our heads. Wade's in here. Where are you, Wade? Over? Yeah. Oh, there you are, yeah. We started scratching our heads, and we started thinking, what is going on here? Why are we getting these spikes? Oops, let me back that up. Why are we getting these spikes on these weights? Well, there's probably a couple of things going on, but I think Wade had the best insight on this. Culturally right now, I'll paraphrase, but you correct me if I'm wrong. Culturally right now, you can't sell a bull. Can't is a strong word. Can't sell a bull unless he has a birth weight. And we know that circumstances are circumstances, especially on large herds. It's hard to catch them all. It's hard to get to them all. So we think what's going on is there are a lot of people that are saying, guessing to the nearest 5-pound increments on the missed calves. Because this looks like real data up until, 10 or 20% of the calves are missed. I think that might be what's going on. There's probably other things going on here, too. You think, Wade? Does that look right? Yeah. And so you can't sell a bull unless he's got a birth weight, which is shame on us, you know. Remember, this is birth weight. This isn't even an economically relevant trait. But it's important because it helps with calving ease and other traits. So we started seeing a lot of that. There's a lot of that in there. Again, I'll show you how much. There's actually quite a bit of data that's still turned in 2018 in 5-pound increments in the contemporary groups. I don't know. I think they might actually be weighed in 5-pound increments, and maybe the calves bouncing on there, and so they just, you know, say, well, closest 5 pounds. We see a lot of 2-pound increments. I don't have a big problem with that, but 5-pound increments in here. So, and that's a little bit problematic. So these last two, the standard fill-in and the 5-pound increments, I think most of that's not fabricated data. I think most of that's some sort of real data, but I classify it as dirty. It's a little bit dirty, the data. And then the other thing that was really interesting. Okay, so gets you the idea of the problems. The other thing that's really interesting here is we started seeing contemporary groups that didn't have enough variation, as in the blue here, that caught in our variation trap, and we were going, oh, God, these guys are just writing down numbers. And then all of a sudden we started looking at who it was. And some of these were, and it tended to be big breeders with large contemporary groups. You can see the one in blue. That's a pretty big contemporary group, right? And this one in particular, and we get to use his name, Wade gave me permission. This is from Gateway, Jimmy Butcher. Well-known breeder, past president of Simmental Association. Really good guy. We work with him a lot. Keeps meticulous data. And we said, what's going on here? Why are we catching guys like Jimmy Butcher, and there are others, some guys in this room? We saw the same thing going, these are good breeders. What's going on? Well, we contacted Jimmy, and he said 10 years ago his back went out on him. And so he started catching, taking birth weights with a hoof tape. And we talked to others, other big breeders, and yep, they're using hoof tapes. A lot of the big operations are using these calf tapes. And so we said, why? You know, a lot of these guys swear by it. They swear it works. It's perfect. Now, There is some literature. I'll show you a little few citations that show that hint at it might working, but no one had ever actually done, at least I can't find anywhere in the literature where they've said, what's the relationship between a hoof tape birth weight and an actual birth weight in terms of genetic correlation. So I took all of Jimmy's data. It's 10 years worth of data. It was 7,700 observations on birth weight. And I took all the data, all the sires that he used in that, a lot of data, 7,700 observations on hoof tape birth weight. And I took those sires and I went, and I have a method for finding good data. And I went and found a big lump of nice large contemporary groups that were classified as good data, real scale weight data without a bunch of dirt and anomalies in it. And out of those same set of sires, and so I ran it as what's called a multi-trait analysis where hoof tape birth weight was a separate trait then actual birth weight and did an analysis to get the variance components out of it. And you can see what the variance components are. Sure enough, the scale weights, phenotypic variance after being adjusted for everything, age of dam, heterosis, etc., is right at the number that we already had in our evaluation for phenotypic variance in the analysis. And you can see the hoof tape variance is about 75-80% of that phenotypic variance. And that's what we were seeing in these other plots. The most important thing was, we estimated the heritabilities from these variance components, and actual scale heritability is 0.55, a little high, but it's not unreasonable at all. We get those kinds of values. Remember, this is the cleanest data I could find. And the genetic correlation between tape and scale was 0.92 with an error of 0.06. In other words, it's not different than one. They're virtually the same trait. They just scale because the hoof tape just, it's an artifact of the hoof tape. They just don't spread the predictions of weight out enough. But according to this evaluation, these are the same trait. Now, I did this with a couple other groups, but I couldn't find as clean a data as Jim's. As Jimmy's, I looked at a couple others, and I could get the genetic correlation down into the mid-0.8s, and I looked at two other groups, but I'd look at the actual data, and there were some fill-in values and some other things going on there, but the standard error on those was much higher than this. This was the largest data set, and it still wasn't different than one. But the most surprising thing here, and this happened in the other data, is the hoof tape heritabilities went way up, 0.75, and we looked at it, Matt here? Matt helped me with this. We looked at this and we were thinking, there's no way this is 0.75 heritable. And I still look at that very skeptically. But, I don't know, I'm rationalizing, post-analysis rationalizing here. Lee and I were talking about it again this morning. Why might the heritability of hoof tape actually be higher than the heritability of birth weight? Anyone? You cheated. Oh, was that Mark that said it? Oh, okay. Yeah. You know, when you catch calf on you usually, you know, what's the guideline? Within 24 hours, is that? Well, they might have suckled, they might not have. That could be a few pounds of birth weight right there. Whereas that would not likely affect the tape measurement. You could, you don't get those kinds of additional sources of air. I don't know. That's one factor. There may be others in there. Is it 0.75? I'm having trouble with that one. We'll continue to work on that. But I've gotten to the point, I've done a 180 on this. I was when I saw this, I thought, oh, all these years. And there's 10 years of Jimmy's data in there. Anyone else in here, you know, want to admit they're using a hoof tape here? Yeah. Right? They're good. Good for you. Honest man there. Well, I'm actually liking these hoof tapes now. So much that, so we've got this project you've heard about, the BIF guidelines. We're putting a wiki together, and I've drafted a page on hoof tape, and you can see there is some literature on it. It's not real strong literature, but most all of it Here's this Nugent paper in here. Read that. It says that hoof tape is related to both birth weight and calving. It's limited amount of data, only, 400 or 500 observations or something. But there's no big study that's really done this and says, yeah, here's the parameters of hoof tape and here's how you use it. We've drafted this. The BIF board has had discussions and debates. Those are ongoing. Is that right? Ongoing. Yeah. But the reality here is we're not going to take hoof tape out of these people's hands. We're not going to change their mind. We're not, if we as an organization, BIF, say hoof tape bad, or a breed association says we won't accept hoof tape data, you'll get it anyway. You just won't know. Yeah, exactly. We already did that. And so let's embrace it. Have them tell us that they're doing it. And let's come up with these methods. And I've got some proposals and then some things I've tested, and I'll show you here, on how to handle it. Because definitely people need an easier way. And maybe even we'll get, if we do that, we'll get less of the fill-in dirty data kinds of things. We'll get less of the 5-pound increment data. And I've got a hoof tape if anyone wants to actually see one. They're only $12, you know, so it's high tech. Anyway, that's kind of where I'm at on my recommendation, and that's really a 180 from where I started. There are two issues with all of these problems in birth weight data, the fabricated data, the dirty data, the hoof tape data. We need a reliable method to identify it in our existing data. We're talking about millions of observations. And then, number two, once we identify it, we need methods to deal with it in the genetic evaluation because it is causing problems. It's guaranteed to be causing problems, and I'll show you why. This is not just a little bit of data. Let's deal with number one, a reliable method to identify it. So we were sitting around thinking, what could we do that's better than the old reporting method that Bob and I worked on 20 years ago? Probably most of you have heard of these kinds of things happening, this whole field of machine learning technically, genetic prediction already is a machine learning approach, but it's been classified in it. But along with that, there's all kinds of other machine learning methods, including deep neural networks. And deep neural networks, I've had a little bit of experience with. It's they're evolving really quickly. That whole data science field of deep neural networks, and that's one type of classification network. But it's a commonly used method in a lot of fields. I'll show you a few examples of that. But they're real good at two types of problems: either problems with a lot of nonlinear relationships. And that's financial data, things like that. They're used in by large institutions for forecasting, financial forecasts. But they're also really good at classification problems. And this is a classification problem. We're trying to take a contemporary group and say, what kind of data problems are in this contemporary group? Is it fake data? Is it dirty data? Is it 5-pound increments? Is it real? You know, and do it quickly and efficiently. And these deep neural networks are kind of this, it's really interesting. You basically throw in a bunch of parameters on the input layer. It goes through a bunch of hidden layer computations. And on the output layer, it throws it into a classification. And here this little diagram says, well, your whatever you threw in comes out as one of four different classifications. And that's just the visual aid to it. But that's kind of how you think about deep neural networks. Well, deep neural networks are used in all kinds of classification problems. Here's one, facial recognition, real common application for deep neural networks where it breaks it down and then starts classifying output into facial recognition problems. Autonomous driving, it's in part built around a lot of deep neural network work, recognizing and classifying objects. There's a car, there's a person, there's a sign. And so cracking images is a big, big tool, or it's a big, big tool in cracking images. It's really getting big in diagnostics, in medical research, using deep neural networks to to parse MRIs or parse X-rays, or to even do classifications of molecules and medications. Let's see. Here's one. I've actually seen this one work. You show it a picture, any picture. You can send a tweet of a picture of your dog, and it'll tell you what breed it is. And but that gives you the idea. It's good at classifying things. The problem here that we faced initially was deep neural networks. You have to get a big data set of well-known data and divide it into a training data set. You have to train your deep neural network. So you design this thing, and then you throw a bunch of data at it, and it that's with known characteristics, like, I know this is dirty data, I know this is fake data, I know this is real data, and train it. And that's a time-consuming process. And then you have to have a test data set that tests how well it's trained, in an independent testing and training step. Well, we don't have that, right? We have a lot of data, but we don't know for certain, is this tape data and is that fabricated data and is that real scale data? So Matt suggested in a phone call one day, he said, hey, let's just simulate it. That's the best we can do. And we can build large amounts of simulated data. It's pretty easy. We built a data generator for birth weight and simulated all the different types of ways we think people could fabricate data or mess up data, make it dirty, that sort of thing, all the different ways. And we decided any contemporary group of less than size 10, you just weren't going to be able to reliably predict. But those weren't the problem ones. And then up to 250, those are some of the larger size contemporary groups. So we broke the data set into 12,000 test observations. That's a large set for anyone. And 120,000 training observations. And they were simulated in one of 12 different ways we came up with that might be going on. Real scale weights is our number one. Tape weights, number two. Random weights with reduced variance. So that's what usually happens when people sit at the desk and start writing down numbers, or in a pickup truck and writing down numbers. They don't get the variance right. They don't get a couple other things right, too, and you'll start to get that. Ocular scales, yeah. Yeah, the ocular scale, right? And if they were looking at them, that should still be better. Real 5-pound increments, real 2-pound increments, real weights, but filled in. So those missing weights where they miss calves. Then fake 5-pound increments. So we took fake and kind of divided it into just fake and then fake 5-pound increments just to try and get a little more granularity on this DNA, but it's all fake data. Real but single animal contemporary group. And there's no problem with real single animal contemporary group. We just had to account for it. Single age of dam contemporary groups. We just had to account for it because age of dam is one of the ways that we start detecting these up here. So we fit that, and we simulate tape but single age of dam, fake but single age of dam. And those, nothing special, nothing wrong with single age of dam. So we simulated the data that way. We parameterized the DNN, and the idea behind parameterizing it is give it enough information that it can capture all the information about what's going on. So we had 141 parameters per contemporary group. It's basically the number of observations at each weight, and we constrained that from 20 to 150 pounds. The average birth weight for each age of dam class, the number of observations by each age of dam class, and the sex of the contemporary group. So on that input layer, it had 141 things coming in. The first hidden, now I played with different topologies. Sometimes building these DNNs is more an art than science, and you just do it all kinds of different ways until you get the best performance out of them. So the first hidden layer was 512 nodes, 256 nodes. I'm going to get a little technical because there's a few people in here who have done some of these things. 128 nodes, to output 12 different possible categories any one group goes in. And so the DNN then trains against the data, tests against the data, and the resulting parameterized DNN will take then a real contemporary group and assign it to one of 12 classes. Just a little more technical information here. The activation function is RELU. This one is a good activation function for this kind of data. The optimizer, these are all parameters on design in the DNN. Our cost function in the DNN was the prediction minus the observation squared. So the idea is to minimize the cost function. But I actually made the decision to choose the best as the maximum correlation between the prediction and the test. And it was almost always the same as the cost function here. Now, here I had a nice video that would have showed you a training session, but we don't have the right video drivers on this computer. So, but the idea is then you turn the thing loose on all this simulated data, and it does it over and over and over and over again for hours and hours. And it just kind of perturbs it a little bit. Each epoch, it's called. It's an iteration. Each epoch perturbs it and then comes back and tries another one and perturbs it again and tries another one. And then you just keep saving off. Every time it gets better, you save off the weights, the DNN weights, until you stop getting better and better and better. This one got... It's a little suspicious because it's so sanitary. It got a correlation up here. The maximum correlation on the best fit was 1.0. It virtually got every one of these categories. A little bit of trade-off at the high end here for 1 and 2. They were, you know, way up here. But all these other categories, it just nailed them. A little bit of trade-off on a couple of them on the end. But the correlations were virtually 1. By the time, and the video would have shown you that. Okay. So here's the output. Now, I've got two different pies. So the 1 through 12, so this is the proportion of data, of real data, that fell into the 1 through 12 categories. This is for all IGS birth weight contemporary groups of size 10 or greater. And this one is for 2018 contemporary groups only. And you go from top to bottom here, you go around clockwise starting down here. All data, 48%, it said. So you train this thing, and then you throw the real data at it, and it predicts what each contemporary group is. 48% of all data were real scale weights, it thinks. They just had the characteristics of real scale weights. Age of dams look right. The distributions look right. Everything was right. Only 48% were right. The good news is in 2018 data, that went up to 58%. So getting a little better. Next one over, 15% of the data was tape weights or had the characteristics of tape weights. I suspect, so we keep hearing these stories out there that those are probably tape weights. Those tended to be large contemporary groups. But I suspect also that one is catching, that category is catching a few other things. We hear these stories about some guys who go out and they weigh the first dozen calves, right, Wade? And they kind of calibrate themselves every calving season. And then they're really good at guessing or ocular scales for the rest of the calves in it. And I suspect that might be some of what's going on here, too. You know, they're looking at them, and they're a little more calibrated. I don't know how much. It's impossible to break those out, I think. Anything else might be going on there, Wade? I mean, sex, age of dam all looks right, and distributions look just compressed. So 10% is random, is fake data. 10%. And that's the just straight up fake. It's just fabricated in 1 pound increments. That's the good news is in 2018 that's down to 5%. Still a lot. I mean, still way too much data. Just, and I showed you examples of it. It's definitely in there. 8% was real 5 pound increments. That's gone down to 3%. 9%, let's see, where are we at? 9% is 5. Real 2-pound increments, yeah. Okay, I have no problem with weighing at 2-pound increments. Those scales are hard to read. Let's see. 7% is number 6. Real weights with fill-in. So 7% has got fill-in. So if you look at, that's the dirty data. You look at that. You look at some of these other fake and dirty classifiers in there. It adds up quite a bit. So I don't know. Am I doing too much arm waving? Is this a problem? Do you think it's a problem? Yeah, it's a problem. Only 58% is clearly done on a scale here. Or maybe not clearly. Maybe there's some guys really good at fabricating data. I don't know. So what do you do about it? Well, I've developed, or at least we've been testing a modeling procedure. I took and first collapsed these into, and there's sensible reasons for doing it. I collapsed the real scale, the real 2-pound, and the real but single age of dam contemporary groups into a single category. I call those category ones. That makes sense. I collapsed the tape weights and the two tape weight categories into number 2. Number 3, the fake ones. Number 3, I'm sorry, is real 5-pound increments, real weights with fill-in, and real 2-pound increments with fill-in all into a third category. They tended to have the same kind of characteristics with the reduced heritability, the higher noise in them. And then I took all the fake categories and collapsed them into 4. So I've now taken 12 and put it into 4 categories. And I worked back in the literature. I apologize for the equation shrinking. That was part of the transition here. So there's a procedure that actually Simmental used to use in their previous evaluation. It's called heterogeneous variance prediction. And it was developed by Dick Kwas and Dorian Garrick. It's kind of a neat procedure. So basically, it models an observation. Let's say observation on birth weight is the mean plus the fixed effects, the Bs, plus, and normally you would just say plus the breeding value U sub I plus just an error sub I. And that's kind of the basic underlying model that we use for observations. But in theirs, they modeled it as this little epsilon coefficient, which is a weighting factor that scales the contribution of the breeding value to the phenotype. And so if you're in a reduced variance situation, it says that only a certain proportion of this or a reduced amount of this will actually be reflected in the observation. And so you have a less than 1 scaling coefficient here. And then the error is also in a class, so you scale the residual variance back for those kinds of observations. And it works pretty well. I've been testing it, implementing it, and I've developed so the category 1s get a 1 with a residual scaling factor of 1. In other words, you don't do anything with them. The category 2s, the tapes, get a 0.866. So 0.866 is the square root of 0.75. In other words, it looks like 0.75 to 0.8 is the variance scale on this epsilon value. I'm still playing with different values of residual here because you saw in the Butcher data the residual went down very, very extreme amounts. It went down to actually 20 squared pounds. And I'm just not buying it. I'm not comfortable there yet. The dirty data, I just leave the solution weight at 1 because if you don't, it actually causes bias. But the residual is scaled up by, I've done it up to 0.5. That's, it's a little bit of a butt pull, but, it looks like it. And the fake data, I've gone back and forth. I've tried to come up with scaling factors here and here to make that work. The goal was to still leave the data in there but have it have no influence. But anything I do just causes bias here. I've kind of come to the conclusion, and this might be news to Wade, we got to throw it out. We just got to throw out everything that falls into that category. Just not use it. Just say it doesn't meet our needs at this time. I think that's where we're at. So we can handle the tape. If I'm right about the tape being just a scaled version of birth weight, this is an easy thing to implement, and it will work. The dirty data, we can reduce its heritability effectively by scaling that up. We just got to get rid of the data that is not reliable. How am I doing, Mark? Got time. Okay, so a few lessons learned. First of all, this is birth weight. Calving ease is the trait here that's important. And we've got to culturally change from putting so much emphasis on birth weight that breeders feel compelled to write in weights when they miss one. You know, nothing wrong with missing a weight. You know, these analyses, the EPDs take care of it, and I'm sorry if, you know, a guy won't buy a bull if he doesn't have an actual weight on it, but that's just the way it is. We are going to get calf tape data no matter what BIF recommends and no matter what anyone else recommends. I think we got to embrace it. I think we got to deal with it aggressively. And what we start realizing, other, quote, technologies are coming. Anybody downloaded Agro Ninja's Beefy app yet? Anybody seen this? I've downloaded it. You can take a picture of an animal, and it'll tell you what the weight is. And they're claiming 95% accuracy. Yeah, right? This stuff's coming. I'd hate to start getting weaning weights for this thing and not know it. There will be others out there. So with that, BIF should make it a mission to be ahead of new technologies. We should be much more aggressive, proactive, encouraging breeders to tell us what they're doing, looking for ways to help them rather than being overly dogmatic about the kind of data that we accept. Questions? In the back here, blue coat.
Have you run any other weight trades outside of birth weight through your simulation, and did you see a similar breakdown?
I have. I've done weaning weight and yearling weight, and I could find one, you know, just a handful of suspicious contemporary groups. It's not a big problem. I think it's so much easier to, you know, just batch weigh animals that it's less prone to the, you know, birth weight. You know, you got to go out there every day or a couple times a day, and sometimes it's in driving snow, and, you know, so I don't see a big problem in the others.
So, follow up, can we, as we start looking at some of these more nonlinear subjective type of traits, docility scores, udder, feet scores, can you do a DNN, I think that's what you called it, that would help even on
I think so. I think that's right. The one I want to look at next is we've got a big project in IGS trying to get mature weights, and Wade's incentivized people to do that by getting low-cost DNA. And I just worry that we got to look at it and make sure people aren't just, you know, grabbing weights in order to get that low-cost DNA. Yeah. Another question? Yeah, right. Bob?
The scale of the fabricated data might not be as large as weaning, but weaning is so important because everything else goes off of it.
Yeah.
So, gosh, I'd be applying it into weaning weight because there is, it may not be as big as birth, but it's still there.
Yeah.
And you got to clean it up. And just two quick things. The other thing is you're going to have to start thinking about, like, too much variation. That's sure there. And last thing, when we had all those fillers, there were like six of them. Rarely did we ever get a call about the EPD changing because we dumped the data.
Yeah.
Which was kind of fascinating that people really weren't paying attention.
Yeah, that's a really good comment. So we'd toss out a pretty substantial amount of data, and people wouldn't ask because, well, who knows why.
Well, you know, just one example. Remember, one sire's birth weight is in this pipe with no variation. Another sire's birth weight is in this pipe with no variation. So they're trying to screw over somebody else.
Oh, yeah, we had a little bit of that, yeah.
See?
Back here in the corner was first.
You
No, we have not. We can probably do that with Jimmy's data. The problem is calving ease, you restrict to only first calf heifers, and so you lose a lot of data. So I'm not sure how powerful. But that begs the bigger question. And we've been encouraging BIF. I'll put Lee on the spot here. Well, you're no longer president. Not your problem. We've been encouraging BIF. I think that's the appropriate place to try and find some dollars or help find some dollars to have a larger study to answer those questions. Look, if it is truly a correlation of one with birth weight, it is birth weight. And so no reason to expect it to be different. But we need to analyze that. Maybe. Let's not assume that. Sue?
So, Bruce, is as you think about how you actually apply this in a pipeline, so would you anticipate that you'll only do the training once, and then you'll be able to take the test populations, so the actual data as it comes in, and you'll make a decision right then? So that's one question. Is that the way you kind of think the pipeline would work?
Yeah, there's no reason to retrain at these volumes unless you find a new anomaly. Yeah. And the prediction is instantaneous once it's trained. So
But are there like linear methods that could be applied after you understand the factors that really influence the differences that would make it really rapid, even if you've got something new, some new category that was fake data?
So rule-based as opposed to DNA? Rule-based is never better. DNNs are wonderful at categorization, much better than rule-based. So.
But you've got it, it took you a couple days to run it?
Well, to train it. But once it's trained.
Yeah, but you're going to have to run it every once in a while because this new device is going to show up that will give you a whole new set of
data. We'll agree to disagree. It's, training is easy. You know, when we're running weekly on predictions, it's training is pretty easy. I really like DNNs. It's a religion for me now. I used to be skeptical like everyone else, but I've done another DNN project where I predict the inverse of the left-hand side, the diagonal elements of the inverse. This thing does amazing predictions of the inverse of the left-hand side. So it's pretty powerful. Mark, we got time for more?
Sure.
Over here? Research needs to be done, but it would be interesting to see if the research tells us, ooh, let's do tape. Yeah. I'm not ready to say that yet, but that would be interesting.
It's something we definitely ought to look at.
Yeah, right?
Absolutely. Shane, do you have a question?
You tell me. That's what I would do. That's what. Could you get away with the change? Those damn guys at Colorado State. Yeah, right.
Out of fight this one call a year. And they didn't notice.
Yeah, or didn't want to poke the bear, take the hornet's nest. Another question?